This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is poet Emily Warren. That's spelled W-A-R-N. Emily, can you hear me all right? We're talking by phone. Emily, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, very good. I was just saying that your name is spelled W-A-R-N and that you're a poet whose most recent book is called Shadow Architect. That just came out this year, 2008, from Copper Canyon Press. This is your third book of poetry with them, I understand.
That's correct.
I was it surprised me. I was at their office out in Port Washington this summer. My wife was there for a reunion with some old college friends, and I was surprised to see that that's where the press headquarters was. I'd enjoyed their books before. I had no idea where they came from. So I went in and, looking through their new books, found this one of yours and was delighted as I started reading it. But I probably read it wrong. I just opened it and looked at a poem and read it and then skipped one way or the other. And that's, as I later read through the whole thing more carefully, I realized that's probably not how you intend readers to be introduced to this particular book.
Well, actually, I think you can start in anywhere. It's a system, but you can begin or end it in any way you want. There are a couple narratives that do have beginnings and ends, but each poem is meant to stand on its own.
As well.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
yes.
How wonderful that you were able to visit Port Townsend. And it's the press is in an old gunnery building on an old fort right on the ocean, so it's quite a beautiful place.
It really was lovely.
Yeah.
And you live in two places yourself, there in the Pacific Northwest, in or near Seattle, and also Chicago.
I do, right. I'm sitting in Seattle right now, and I work for the Poetry Foundation in Chicago.
And so how often do you fly back and forth?
Well, I've been mostly living in Chicago and coming home to Seattle about 10 days a month. So I fly back and forth about once a month.
Well, tell us about Shadow Architect. It's a fascinating book based on the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. Tell us how you got intrigued by that.
Sure. I was raised as an Orthodox Jew in Detroit. That's where my accent comes from. And learned how to study Torah and Talmud, but fell away from Judaism in that Orthodox Judaism in my day and age didn't have much role for women in ritual. But I found my way back to it in part by writing not this book, but an earlier book called The Book of Esther. It's a small chapbook. And in Judaism, one of the quintessential acts of Judaism is to interpret a story or word even and share that interpretation with others. And so this book, Shadow Architect, is an interpretation of the Hebrew alphabet, and in Judaism you call that a midrash, so it's my midrash or interpretation of the Hebrew letters. And for centuries, different rabbis and sages have made great claims about the Hebrew letters, claiming that they have great creative powers, that if you utter them in certain combinations, you can come into the divine presence. You can even create a golem, a human being. And all of these claims really have their source in Genesis. When God speaks the universe into being, he says, "Let there be light," and there was light. So this is not a religious text, though. It's an artistic text. So what we were looking at, it began as a collaboration with a visual artist, and we looked at what does it mean that the immaterial creates the material, the language, which has no physical form. Well, it does is type, of course, on a page, but really it's meant to be, it's uttered. How can it be that the immaterial creates the material? And so we then collaborated, and Dennis Evans, who is the visual artist, created 22 kits, and my poems we thought of as almost manuals, that if you had these kits and these manuals, you could invent a universe. So that's kind of the idea behind the book itself, and I can go into more detail about the poems, but I'll stop for a moment here.
Well, let me just remind listeners, we hope potential readers, that we're talking with Emily Warren, W-A-R-N, the author of the just-published book, Shadow Architect, a book of poetry, based on the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. And she's, Emily, if I may call you by your first name.
Sure.
You and Dennis Evans did this joint project. Now, the result of your book is available around the world. What about the results of his kits, these 22 kits? Can they be seen online?
At the moment, no. We had an exhibition. He's a fairly prominent very prominent Northwest visual artist. Oh. And we have a website in the works, but we just haven't launched it yet.
So that's yet to come.
Right. If you buy the book, or you could see one of the pieces on the cover, The Sound of the Exiles, which is for the letter Pei. And Dennis actually invented an alphabet for our project so that you could actually invent words according to the narrative. Now, that sounds complicated, but the poems are very accessible, and in part because there's this underlying story and underlying structure to each poem.
They're indeed, your poems are indeed accessible from this one reader's perspective, but they're also very deep, I found. I was moved emotionally, and I felt spiritually, although I'm not from the Jewish tradition myself, but I appreciated them very much. Let's give listeners a taste of them. We read these on the air by permission, of course, of the author who's with us, and from Copper Canyon Press. Might there be one of the poems a series of the three, perhaps, that you'd like to read for our listeners to get us a taste of this?
Sure. Why don't I begin with the letter Beit, which is the second letter in the alphabet, and the poem is called The House of Musing. And I'll read one poem just so you get a taste of it, and then explain a little about the structure and the background that informs it. The House of Musing. The trick, to live without survival kits, miracles, bottled water, fire starters, spells, to stop grumbling to God and build your hut in the wilderness. No need to search or not search. Just join haystack to haystack, bale to bale, until thick walls swathed with mud appear. From within, the doorway frames the quiet of a tree with a single leaf. You're safe to examine the distance you've crossed, how you lived not knowing you lived, how you postponed this reckoning, believing you lacked a desire to know. Yet here you are, listening to a leaf scrape air, your hands smeared with mud.
The poem, The House of Musing, read by the poet, collected in her book, Shadow Architect. Thank you, Emily Warren. So tell us a little bit about the letter Beit and this particular poem. Now, this is the second in a series of three on this letter in the Hebrew alphabet. So tell us about the series and about this poem.
Sure. So the structure underlying each letter actually comes from the founder of Hasidism, Baal Shem Tov, which means in Hebrew, the master of the good name. And he said that each letter has actually three symbolic levels. It exists as a form, which relates to the world. It exists as a name, which relates to the soul. And it exists as a number, which relates to divinity. So in this case, the letter Beit, its form, looks like an open tent door. So it's similar to some Chinese ideograms in that they resemble a form in the world, a shape in the world. There's a short, each poem itself actually has four parts. I read the second part. The first part always relates to its form, and the second part always relates to its name or on a soul level, and the third part always relates to its number or its relation to divinity. So in the case of the Beit, its number two relates to the mystery of multiplicity and unity. And So every poem in the book has these three parts, and then it has one more section, which are what, in when you study Torah, you call proof texts. So when you study Torah at a synagogue on Saturday morning, say, or some other time during the week, you might offer your interpretation, and then to support it, bring in it, another passage in the Torah or in the Talmud or from another book you might find or from your own life, your own experience. So in this case, I have three proof texts, and maybe I can read those so you get a sense of those.
Yes, please do.
The first one is from Aidan Steinsaltz from his book called The 13-Petaled Rose, and he's a great Talmudic scholar who's actually been translating the Talmud into English. But this is from a short book about Jewish mysticism, and he says that creation is an emanation from the divine light. Its secret is not the coming into existence of something new, but the transmutation of the divine reality into something defined and limited into a world. The second proof text is just from Exodus, which is says, "In that place I will allow you to speak my name." And the third proof text.
And that's God speaking in that case.
Yes, yes. Thank you. And then it is from a psalm, Psalm 15:1. "Lord, who may sojourn in your tent? Who may dwell in your holy mountain?" So the poem is an answer to that question. It's in the first nine poems of the book. It's a journey of creating a self or a soul, and the second stage in that journey is finding a dwelling place, creating a dwelling place for the spirit. So the house of musing is really an answer to who may sojourn in your tent. Well, you can invent your own dwelling place and your own relationship to the divine or to art, and that's the idea behind that poem. I know that's complicated, but I think you can hear from listening that the poems themselves are supported by this structure and so allow you to experience it better, I think.
And you explained very well in your foreword how what you were thinking about in your preface, actually, of how you were thinking of how you created this, and it does help the reader understand that the first nine are a story that has a line to it that goes through those nine, and then the next are trials. How would you feel about reading one of the trials to give readers a very different sense of
sure.
I'm thinking of, if you might be willing, Yod on page
sure.
62, the tenth letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It's a very strong set of poems.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps
maybe I should just read the first two and explain a little.
Yes, that'd be great.
So Yod is the number 10. And it looks like an apostrophe. It's the tiniest letter, and it means the hand of God. But it's come to mean the sparks that were left when God withdrew from the world. So one of the major questions in Judaism is, if God is infinite, how can the finite exist within the infinite? And so they explain that in order for the finite to exist, God had to withdraw. Well, as a Jewish person in the 20th and 21st century, one has to reconcile or confront the Holocaust, and that not only do we live in a finite world, but we live in a broken world. And God, in many ways, is also broken. And so these two poems are looking at the brokenness of the world. Handiwork. At dawn, God opens one hand to let cramped darkness flee. All night, clouds of glory float beyond reach of dreams, beyond a prayer book and a clock, which wait with you until dawn to help you wrestle the dark back into God's other hand.
Handiwork, the first poem, on the in the section The Soul's Chisel, the second section of the book, for the 10th letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Yud, the Hand of God, read by the author Emily Warren from her book Shadow Architect. And you were willing to read also the second?
Sure, I could also read the third too if you like, but this is the Hand of God, and I wrote this after visiting the Holocaust Memorial in Washington, D.C. They scratched your names on wooden slats, in soot, on paper scraps, in Bergen-Belsen, Auschwitz, Babi Yar. In Warsaw, they buried Torahs in rusty milk cans with keepsake diamonds, eyeglasses, fountain pens. No rescue arrived, no maps with dotted lines, no gruel, no clothing, no sheltering dust. What they possessed were your names, the little that is much, the point of a yud, a speck of hope that someone would hear what they had seconds to say before firing squads, whipped wind, toppled them, broken dolls into graves. First one spoke, then 10, then 10 times 10, until a murmuring arose, Elohim, Havaya, Adonai, El Shaddai, Hashem, Havaya, Shekhinah, Asherah, summoning all the names where you were not, until all that was or will be became Elohim, Havaya, Shekhinah, gathering outstretched hands to heaven.
The poem, The Hand of God, that includes many of the biblical names for God that the poet Emily Warren was just reading for us from her book, Shadow Architect. This is a live call-in program, and in a moment I'm going to give the phone numbers so the listeners may call who have a question or a comment. Before that, I will ask Emily to read the third poem that's a very contemporary, deals with very contemporary issues in this series called The Vanishing Point. But let me give the phone numbers now, but I'll warn listeners I won't be getting to those until after she finishes reading this this poem. But in Champaign-Urbana, where the program originates, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Elsewhere, and at this time of many people may be listening online, and there's a toll-free number you may use from anywhere in the continental U.S., 1-800-222-9455. So a toll-free number, 1-800-222-WILL, to be on the air with our guest live, Emily Warren, who's speaking with us from her home in Seattle. Well, let's do here the third poem in this series on the 10th letter in the Hebrew alphabet. It's part of this long Jewish mystical tradition, but a poem that's very contemporary.
Thank you. So the third poem in for every letter is a prose poem. So what I'm about to read is prose. And just as in studying Torah and Talmud, you interpret a story, the third poem is always an interpretation of the first two poems, and of, in this case, the trial is grappling with infinity. What does it mean that God is infinite and that we're finite, and that included in the infinite is what is broken? So this is called The Vanishing Point. You slow down to watch cumulus clouds stream across the sky. You choose a more circuitous route home and pass a tree with white bags tied around random apples. The apples remind you of clouds, how each hangs in the sky, singular yet part of a flock. Each item in the flock is a coordinate of earth and sky, enumerating space. The flocks of apples and clouds are actual infinities, an endless collection of discrete items that one can conceivably count to the end. This is different from potential infinity, which is the entirety of infinity, an immeasurable continuum that is greater than the sum of its parts. After your first glimpse, you are lonely for more contraction of space around the light of your mind, contemplating what cannot be conceived. What cannot be conceived this morning? The army has found the larynx of an Iraqi man that American soldiers slowly strangled to death. His ribs, additional evidence for the trial, are still missing. They are in a refrigerator in Washington, D.C. these are discrete items, whereas how the passage of time felt as the soldier strangled him is a continuum of infinite pain. And his words and songs and prayers and curses he will never speak are an empty set.
The Vanishing Point, read by author Emily Warren, that's spelled W-A-R-N, from her book Shadow Architect, read by permission of Copper Canyon Press, and of course the author herself. The last section of this are, again, three proof texts, as you said. One from Job: my groaning serves as my bread, my roaring pours forth as water. Another from Isaiah, referring to God: he hid me in the shadow of his hand. And I'm not sure how to pronounce the author of the third.
Perkei the Rabbi Eliezer.
Before the creation of the world, he and his name were alone.
I think so, it's getting at God's loneliness.
Yes.
And our loneliness for God. And
you mentioned how the third poem in this series is always a prose poem, a midrash, an interpretation of the first two. How do you go about writing the prose poem differently than the other two that are in a more traditional poetic form?
Well, I think it's the subject matter that dictates their prose. In other words, they're more philosophical questioning or intellectual questioning of what is infinity. The number 10 is symbolic of infinity in that one of the questions you ask is how do you get from zero to one? You know, how can you count from zero to one? So the fact that I'm questioning and thinking and being more rational leads to prose as opposed to poetry, which is not always true for all poetry. But in this book, I try to be more lyrical in the first two poems and more rational. And there, of course, in most poetry, reason and emotion are combined, but we're quickly in the 20th and 21st century doing away with all those notions of poetry. But anyway, that's a long answer to your question.
let me encourage listeners to join our conversation. I'll give the numbers again: 333-9455 if it's a local call in the Champaign-Urbana area. Elsewhere, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Emily, tell us a little bit about the numbering of the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. There are 22 of them, but the numbers are not just from 1 to 22. They go up to 9 and then go to 10, 20, 30, and then up to 100, 200, 300, 400.
That's right. It's just a different way of counting them than our system. You just combine them differently. So in our system, of course, numbers and letters are entirely separate. We don't say A is 1 and B is 2. But in Hebrew, you do. They're not separate. But then once you, let me get to my little cheat sheet here.
Well, page 122 is what I'm looking at for your, under Kuf.
Yes, Kuf. Right. So once you get to 10, Yud is 10, but then Kaf is 20, Lamed is 30, Mem is 40, and so on to 100. So that's how you count. It's more similar to, say, Roman numerals. But great, there's something called gematria, and one of the ideas behind our book is that by inventing a narrative and our own alphabet, we could also perform a kind of gematria with the book itself, which is why, as you did, it's perfectly all right, in fact, encouraged to enter anywhere. And what gematria is let's say you count up your name. So my Hebrew name, let's say Aleph. Let's just take a letter. So Aleph would be 1, and this Lamed would be the next letter, and that's 20. I don't use the language very much to count. So you add up a word, and then you find a similar some in the Torah. So let's say in the beginning, you counted up all the letters according to what numbers they represented, and then you found another phrase or another word with those exact same numbers or sum, you would then say that that was a divine connection and study those connections in order to reveal something about the divine or how to live your life or the meaning of a story. So for this book, what we did is the first nine letters, as you said, are a journey. Aleph is human, so you shoulder the yoke of being human. Beit is house, so you build a dwelling place. Gimel is teacher. You find a teacher, and then you're initiated, and so on. And so we attached a word to each of those stages on the journey, human, house, teacher, door, so that when you spell one of our letters, like if you spelled Aleph, Aleph, Lamed, Pei, it would actually mean spell out a word or a sentence, human inspiration spells. Now, I know that sounds really wild and complicated, but we're just being playful because we're artists and we're not intending this to be a religious text and looking at how religion itself is invented in many ways and comes through humans longing for God and longing for beauty and or longing to just understand something terrible that's happened, as in the poem I just read, and that you can play with the correspondences in the same way that people play with correspondences, both in these sacred texts, but also just in ordinary daily life. Something will happen to you, some coincidence, and you'll try to draw meaning from it. Well, is that meaning invented, or is it true? Is it a truth? And I think that is one of the impulses behind this, that both sacred texts and sacred traditions have great meaning for us, and at the same time, they're very much, and to my mind, invented. And the reason that they have so much power is that they're continually reinvented over centuries and transmitted. So to find your place into one and to play with that tradition is you're really playing with fire. That's what we hope these poems would convey.
We have a caller waiting on line one. You're on the air now with Emily Warren. Go right ahead.
Yay, hooray. Thank you for covering this topic. I think most people who have heard the term Kabbalah would unfortunately associate it with...
I can barely hear you.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay, well, our engineer is pumping up the volume here. I think
Thank you very much.
Could you start again, caller?
Oh, sure. Yay, hooray. this is a great topic. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I think, unfortunately, most people who hear the term Kabbalah, QBL, or KBL, would associate it with Madonna, which is a rather esoteric, mystic form, I think, of almost more ritual magic form of it. People may not be aware that it is the descendant of the oral tradition of the Hebrew, although what we have is probably only 500 years old. It may have mythic roots much older than that. And what I think is important is you hear all these things about, oh, the Bible code. Well, you've just mentioned what the Bible code actually is, that frequently when they say something like, and Methuselah lived to be, 999 years old, the important part is that there is probably a word which corresponds to that number, 999, be it, I don't know, I'd have to look it up, righteousness or virtue would be my guess. And I think a lot of people don't understand that such as, the secret name, Tetragrammaton, and things like that, that these were hidden in the numbers. And then what makes it even more confusing is that the vowels are not written. So it's kind of an ambiguous text. But I'm very glad to hear you talk about recreating the mythology and that people should play with the mythology, because to truly understand Kabbalah, one needs to bring it in and internalize it, and part of that is that storytelling. So I'm just thrilled to hear you talking about this, and I'll get off the phone.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the comment.
Thank you for bringing up the Kabbalah. This is very much one of the sources for this is the Kabbalah, but in fact, the word Kabbalah has come to mean many things to many people. And in fact, Kabbalah is so I'm a little bit hesitant to talk about it, but its source is texts from the 13th century in that wonderful time in human history when the Jews and the Muslims and the Christians all got along on the Iberian Peninsula, and just after that when several books were written all about the power of the Hebrew alphabet and about their creative generative powers and what one could experience, both divine and human, if one could manipulate or permute them. But there are many texts, there are multiple texts. There's the Book of the Zohar, there's Sefer Yetzira, and then there's several other texts. So the actual writing of those texts was completed over several centuries. So current Kabbalah is based on that, but there's definitely no one definitive Kabbalah, and it's very much part of Judaism, just as all mystic traditions arise within a very specific religious tradition, and they generally promise a direct experience with God when the other rituals of the larger religion have grown ossified or stale or dry, along comes mysticism. So, yes, it is. I think it is very playful and endlessly so, endless interpretations. And I think that what you just said, that to internalize it is very much about inventing your own story or your own interpretation or your own beauty or own form.
We're about halfway through our program today of Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. Our guest today is Emily Warren, author of Shadow Architect. We're talking about her book based on the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. We'll be getting back to her in just a moment and hear more of her wonderful poetry and talk about the creative process a bit and spirituality as it's tied to poetry. But let me take just a moment to tell listeners that next week our guest here on Keeping the Faith will be Professor Deborah Kapp from Chicago, talking about worship forms, primarily in the Christian tradition. On November 30th, our guest will be Professor Matthew Bolton from Harvard Divinity School, also talking about Christian worship. On December 7th, Mark Rivera will be our guest, talking about the values found in student newspapers today, college student newspapers. Then Bob Cathy from Chicago will be talking about Jewish-Christian religious dialogue on December 14th. And we have the author Claude Edgerton, a wonderful novelist, one of the funniest writers in America today, talking about his recent book, The Bible Salesman, on December 21st. So those are some of the programs coming up ahead on Keeping the Faith here on WILL AM 580. If you've missed part of this program and would like to hear it, these programs are archived at WILL.illinois.edu. Go to AM and then click on Keeping the Faith, and this program will be up in a week or two, and previous programs are archived there. So if you've missed any, that's a way to catch up. Here in Champaign-Urbana, this program is sponsored in part, has been for a number of years, by the University YMCA. And coming up this Tuesday at the University Y at the University of Illinois, Professor Tony Endress will be speaking at noon Tuesday about changing environments. He's the professor of natural resources and environmental sciences at the university. Changing environments, both inside and outside of the classroom. He'll be talking about student projects that took place in Mexico and Puerto Rico and in this country. That's Tuesday noon at the Y, a free lecture. You can pick up a lunch at the Thai eatery there if you like, or bring your lunch, or simply slip in to hear the lecture and the discussion. That's Professor Tony Endress this Tuesday noon at the YMCA. That's November 18. Also, I'll mention that the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute starts up again next semester here at the University of Illinois for people 50 and over, retired folks particularly. There's a number of classes you can learn about by going to their website, olli.uiuc.edu. You'll see the list of classes. One of them is one I'll be teaching on Tuesdays for 8 weeks, starting January 27th, on Islam, Multiple Perspectives. And I'll be bringing in a number of practicing Muslims to talk with people in the class about their faith and practice. It goes from 3:30 to 5 on Tuesdays, starting January 27th. If you'd like to register for that, the registration is open now. If you're already a member of OLLI, it's just $25. If you're not a member, you can see on the website how to become one. There are a lot of benefits being a member of this continuing education opportunity. Osher Lifelong Learning Institutes. They're found all over the country. About 150 universities have them. The one here in Illinois is relatively new, but many people already are appreciating this this opportunity. Well, let's get back to our guest today, Emily Warren. Emily, you mentioned that you started in Detroit as you were raised as an Orthodox Jew and sort of got away from that because of concerns with a woman's place in Orthodox Judaism. What brought you back?
What brought me back was a tragedy, actually. Of someone being actually some friends of mine who were murdered because someone thought they were Jewish and communists, and it happened in many years ago now, but it was very haunting for me. I mean, it was tragic, but it was also that I grew up around Holocaust survivors. I was born in 1953, and when I was raised, people really weren't talking about the Holocaust like they have subsequently done. And when you're a young child, being so soon after that, we were taught about the Holocaust, so we'd never forget it. And as a child, your imagination is graphic, so those images stay with you. But you don't have really a moral sensibility or an ethical sensibility then. So to have fallen away and then to have lose such friends for that reason really made me think at that point, well, if something like that were to happen again, I would be counted as a Jew. And it just something happening like that. And so I wrote a book called The Book of Esther, in which I reinterpreted that book in the Torah. And what I found remarkable about the story is that she saved the Jewish people by keeping her religion a secret and revealing it at just the right time, using her feminine kind of wiles to know just exactly when to tell the king that she was Jewish. So it plays with it, but it was also a way to heal from that experience and to write myself back into the tradition by interpreting it. And I kind of never looked back. I taught as a professor in Virginia, joined a synagogue there, and that was remarkable, being part of a Jewish synagogue in the South. I hadn't ever lived in the South before, and people thought of Judaism as a place of tolerance, a place where they could turn if they felt intolerance. And so the rabbi there is, I worked with him, Rabbi Tom Guthertz, on this book. We would study the letters together. And so I kind of went from needing to write myself back into it as a woman and to just now just being studying it and practicing and observing and playing with it.
You taught in Virginia. What was the school?
At Lynchburg College in Jerry Falwell's hometown.
But not his university.
No, not Liberty College, Lynchburg College.
Now, a Jew in that part of the South is very much a minority.
It is, yeah. And it's wonderful synagogues there in the South, though. And was interesting that many of the people in the synagogue were originally Baptists, but they had kind of, which was very unusual for me because when I grew up in Detroit, I didn't remember anybody who converted except if they married into it, Judaism. So,
where did you go to college yourself?
I went to school at Kalamazoo College in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and then later the University of Washington, and then Stanford as a Stegner Fellow.
Tell us about that program.
How would you like to know about it, did you say?
Yeah, tell us about the Stanford program.
That is a two-year program. It's a wonderful program. I'm not sure how many people they admit now. It's probably about 10 poets every 2 years. And there's no degree, but you get money to live on, and you have to come to a workshop once or twice a week. So it's basically just 2 years to write. And I wrote my last book there called The Novice Insomniac. It's just a wonderful, wonderful program.
And how did you end up in both Seattle and Chicago?
Well, I ended up in Seattle because when I left Judaism, what I turned to with equal devotion was the earth or the wilderness. So in my 20s, I worked for the Park Service and the Forest Service and had a permanent job in North Cascades National Park.
Where is that?
It's right on the border of Canada and Washington State, and it's where Gary Snyder wrote his poems in his first books. He was a lookout ranger, and it's very mountainous. But I worked all over the West, and then came down to University of Washington to earn an MA in creative writing, and so. That's how I ended up in Seattle. And when I came back from my Stegner Fellowship, I was broke and took a job at Microsoft, writing a book about Windows 95. And one of my chapters in that book, there were several of us writing it. It was a resource kit for Windows 95 for IT administrators. You know, as a poet, you can't really earn a living unless you're a professor.
So
all of us find ways to support our writing.
So how poetic did your book on Microsoft Windows turn out to be?
Not very. No, but I wrote a little chapter in there that no one cared about at the time, except me and the test guy on Netscape Navigator, and then the Internet happened, and I ended up being hired by Microsoft and running Internet Explorer and Windows and sites, and I actually coded the first couple, and I think as a result of that, that's partly one of the things underlying this book, Shadow Architect, is that there is a system to it, and understanding how the operating system works and how software code works is fascinating to me. And I retired from Microsoft and then did what you're supposed to do, went to be a professor. But I actually prefer working in the world to being in academia. I just like creating and inventing things with people. And so when the Poetry Foundation, Poetry Magazine, is originally that, received a gift from Ruth Lilly.
Of $100 million.
Yes, no small gift. They decided to create an audience for poetry, looked out at the landscape of the art form of poetry and said what poetry needs is more readers, and said that one way to get those readers or to help people find great poetry is the Internet. And a friend of mine is the editor there at Poetry Magazine, and he kept calling me about this job. And eventually I decided to do it because I thought it was something to contribute. So it's a wonderful site. I don't mean to promote it. I didn't intend to, but we have over 8,000 poems, and there's...
Tell us how to find it.
It's poetryfoundation.org, and we publish articles about how to read poems. The contents of Poetry Magazine are there every month. Wonderful new poems by many contemporary authors, and book reviews, the news. We have 7 podcasts, one of which was carried by NPR, called Poetry Off the Shelf. There's a Poetry Magazine podcast. So if you want to learn about poetry or you're already a poet and want to participate on our blog, we have a blog called Harriet, named after Harriet Monroe, who was the founder of Poetry Magazine back in 1912. It's just so that's what I've been doing for 3 years. I took my what I learned at Microsoft and kind of applied it to the world of poetry.
And how has the response been? Because the difficulty for poetry in our time is often finding readers.
It is. It is. It's been great. It's been surprising. We won a Webby Award, which is very, it's like an Emmy on the web the first year we were operating. And what's been surprising to us, I guess not so surprising to you as the host of a radio show, is that people are really downloading and listening to our audio poems and to our podcasts. And so that here's this new technology that returns poetry to people, and it's one of its original forms of oral poetry, just like you were talking about the Torah, that or the Kabbalah. I think that caller who called in, the Kabbalah is about the oral Torah, and poetry is very, here I'm trying to connect two strands, this is how my mind works, but the oral poetry is we're reaching many, many, many people through people listening to poems.
Well, let's give our listeners here on Keeping the Faith this afternoon another chance to listen to some of your poems, which you read so well, from your 2008 book, Shadow Architect, published by Copper Canyon Press, who have given us permission to read these on the air. Of course, people can go to search for Copper Canyon, can find this book, Shadow Architect, in bookstores and online and to order. But let's listen as Emily Warren reads another poem. Let me give the phone numbers for listeners who might like to call with a response, either to this poem or some of the issues we've raised. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free call. Emily Warren.
Thank you. I think what I'll do is read the title poem, Shadow Architect. It's the letter Nun. And it's called the Shadow Architect because Shadow is the Hebrew name of Bezalel in the Torah. He was the architect, the master artist who built the tabernacle. And to shadow means to emulate God.
And the tabernacle was a movable place of worship while the Israelites were in the wilderness.
That's correct. So it was a movable temple, and inside it are many legends, but inside it are supposedly the broken tablets and also the whole tablets that they from Mount Sinai. And so the idea here is that Bezalel also had a knowledge of the power of the letters and how to permute them. And in doing that, he was helping with the ultimate purpose of creation, which is that it become a kind of house of God. So I'm going to read the very short poem at the beginning, and then I'm going to read the poem called The Tabernacle. So the first poem is called The Shadow Architect. He shoulders a portable temple for words, a holy space with no purpose, other than to house the name for what has no measure, no height, no width, no circumference, yet is what truths our days. This is called The Tabernacle, and it's about Bezalel in his studio. Hope fills me this morning as I fashion letters into a tree that sighs, that stays put yet moves, reaching to its limits, swaying and settling, a compass pointing to its place on earth, where every morning it blocks the sun for me at work in my studio, where I scratch and scrawl and loop letters into shapes so I can enter the tabernacle of their bodies and hear each foot, each syllable, sending its roots to a depth as great as that tree's, which has been standing and rooting and swaying long before I came to memorize its plain mystery, its wide-bodied hull open to stars at night, each a point that I lengthen into a letter and each letter into a word, and with the words build a tabernacle for the 10 most broken and the 10 most resonant words. I will place them in an inner sanctum enclosed by hanging carpets, and outside it, another space enclosed by carpets, and outside it, another, so that those who wish to read the words, to say them out loud, must first pull one curtain back and step inside, and then another, and another, until they arrive in a hushed space, a soundproofed, heavy quiet, where they come to know that which makes all things day after day, and out of which the earth was made. Stepping behind each curtain, they learn that the mystery of making is not a secret hidden within, but a series of moves, a sequence of steps outlined on a blueprint with notes and call-outs, white on black, constellations in the night sky, the primordial living Torah circulating in the letters as trees circulate light, capturing it with their leaves, caching it within the soil, then drawing it back up, watering the tallest branches with the radiant dark.
The Tabernacle, the second of the series of three poems for the letter Nun in the Hebrew alphabet. Before that, The Shadow Architect, both written and read by the author Emily Warren, W-A-R-N, from her book Shadow Architect, also read by permission on the air from Copper Canyon Press, the publisher of her of three of her books of poetry. Emily, when you think about writing these poems in this tradition, from this long Jewish tradition that's focused on the importance of words and what words can create, the stories in Genesis, of course, are read and appreciated not only by Jews, but also by Christians, by Muslims, and many secular people, just for their literary value, if not for their spirituality. But as you start thinking about this, does it scare you to try to add something to this tradition that's so ancient?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it does. I had to live a long time in order to write this book. I approach it with great trepidation. The name of God is not spelled out in English in Orthodox Judaism, and if you make the mistake of writing out God's name, there's a special bin at the synagogue where you put the paper scrap and then you burn it while you say prayers over it. So to write these poems, I did feel fear, but and really the original meaning of awful, you know, that it's that the power of language and the power of God's 70 names is something that you do approach with reverence and awe. And at the same time, I think that all religious traditions need to be living traditions, that they need to be inhabit our lives, and we need to inhabit them. And so how do you do that? Well, if you're a poet, you would write poems. If you're a craftsman like Bezalel, you'd build tabernacles. So I think that I did approach it with trepidation, but I think it's important to participate, to play.
And as you did that, how did you reach the decision to, in several places, spell out the word God on the page? For example, with Yud, the hand of God, when you quote from some of the ancient rabbis, you put G and then a dash and then D.
Mm-hmm.
You chose not to do that in other places. How did you come to that decision?
Well, I think that I was respecting their tradition and their faith. And so if I'm quoting from their work in which they do not spell out God's name, I need to respect that as much as you wouldn't want to plagiarize or misquote anyone. But I wanted my work to reach beyond Jewish readers. I wanted it to be about everyone's spiritual journey or just not a spiritual journey at all, just poems that are about, you know, the mystery of making or what beauty is or what it means to be human or what it means to lose someone. And those are all sources of poetry. And so God is a kind of come to have a more... God means a lot of things to a lot of people, that one word. And I wanted many people to be able to read and approach these texts. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. We're down to our last couple minutes, and I hate to ask a big question, but I just can't resist. What do you think of bad religious poetry? Because there's so much of it.
There is a lot of bad religious poetry. I think it is hard to write in a religious tradition, but I think bad religious poetry tells you what to think. It gives you the answers. It makes it so it hits you over the head. I think that's the best way to say it. And I think one of the wonderful things about Judaism is that the Torah is endlessly analyzed and interpreted. So when the caller called in about the oral tradition, there's a saying that if you write down the oral tradition, the oral Torah, you know, you've burned it. If you write it down, you're committing a grave mistake. And that's because it's, you know, it's part of this living faith. And so to write a poem with the word God in it, you want it to have that same kind of openness as the Torah does every time you open it, that you can, many people can read many meanings in it. And I think bad religious poetry is like bad religion, that you read these books and you say, here's the answer and here's how you should apply it and here's how you should live your life, when in fact I think the most intimate way to know God is to not know. And not know who God is, but to always be asking that question.
I believe that's a perfect place to end our interview this afternoon on Keeping the Faith with shadow architect author Emily Warren, W-A-R-N. Her new book came out in 2008 from Copper Canyon Press, Shadow Architect, using the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet as a way to think about many important things, which we've heard about from her today. I want to thank our one caller and for calling and making a very good comment. And for our other people who chose not to call, I think today particularly because they were fascinated hearing and wanted to hear as much as possible from our wonderful poet and guest today, Emily Warren. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with Deborah Kapp, a professor from Chicago, about worship forms in the Christian tradition. And from Harvard Divinity School, the following week, November 30th, Professor Matthew Bolton, undergraduate student Mark Rivera, talking about values in college newspapers today on December 7th. Professor Bob Cathy talking about Jewish-Christian religious dialogue December 14th, and novelist Clyde Edgerton about his new book, The Bible Salesman, December 21st. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, which are sponsored in part by the University Y, where Tony Endress will be speaking Tuesday noon at Know Your University. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.